Welcome, everybody, to History Analyzed. I'm your host, Mark Palmer. This is a podcast which examines historical events, issues, and people. The person we're analyzing today is Wyatt Earp. Wyatt Earp is probably the most famous lawman from the Old West. I love that term they used in those days, lawman. And the single thing that he is most known for is the shootout at the OK Corral on October 26, 1881. It's something that really bothered Wyatt Earp. He used to say that a man's life should not be defined for what happened in 30 seconds. Sorry, Wyatt, but it's the most famous gunfight in the Old West. And before I go any further, I know that some people listening to this episode are saying, the shootout did not occur at the OK Corral. That's true. To be accurate, it was a gunfight in about an 18-foot-wide empty lot on Fremont Street between Fly's Photography Studio and the Harwood House. The OK Corral itself was located on Allen Street, but there was a rear entrance to the OK Corral on Fremont Street. The famous gunfight took place about six lots west of the rear entrance to the OK Corral. It's unclear how the shootout became known as the gunfight at the OK Corral. But once that title became attached to this gun battle, it's stuck ever since. So even though it's a misnomer, I will continue to use that title since that's how everybody refers to the most famous shootout in the history of the Old West. Why is the shootout at the OK Corral so legendary? There were lots of gunfights like this in the Old West, right? Actually, no. It's true, there were lots of shootouts in the Wild Wild West. But most of the time, they were one-on-one. And most of the homicides in those western towns in the 1800s occurred because of young men, who were usually drunk, got into some kind of argument, which resulted in gunplay. And those one-on-one encounters were not those gallant duels where two men faced each other in the middle of the street and drew their pistols at each other. More often than not, one drunk shot another drunk in the back or shot him when he was unarmed. There were certainly times when two groups of armed men shot at each other, but the opposing sides were usually behind something or at least seeking cover. The shootout at the OK Corral was unusual because you had two groups standing within about 10 feet of each other and just shooting with no place to hide. But mostly, the OK Corral shootout became so famous because of the legend of Wyatt Earp. Before I go on to describe the real Wyatt Earp, we first have to talk about how he became a mythical character. In the late 1800s, there were so-called dime novels written about famous Western characters like Wild Bill Hickok, Buffalo Bill Cody, Kit Carson, Jesse James, Billy the Kid, and Wyatt Earp. Most of those dime novels had very little, if any, basis in fact, but they were the pulp fiction of their day. And there were newspaper articles about Wyatt Earp during his life, including stories about him in the National Police Gazette. Those articles made him a national figure. But what really made Wyatt Earp a true legend was a biography which was published in 1931, just 2 years after his death, entitled Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal. To call it a biography is being very charitable. There was a lot of pure fiction in that book, but it shaped the 20th century image of Wyatt Earp as the greatest lawman in the Old West. This led to many movies about Wyatt, including John Ford's My Darling Clementine in 1946, and two big budget Hollywood films that came out within a year of each other, Tombstone in 1993 with Kurt Russell as Wyatt Earp, and 1 year later the movie simply titled Wyatt Earp, starring Kevin Costner. And there were several other movies which built the myth of Wyatt Earp. There was even a hit TV show from 1955 through 1961 entitled The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp. Wyatt did lead an extraordinary life. It's just that the mythmakers have added so many complete fabrications to it that it's difficult to know what truly occurred. Throughout this episode, I often refer to him just by his first name because there are several Earp family members involved in this episode. And you're going to hear me saying that there are some aspects of the life of Wyatt Earp that we think occurred, but we're not really sure. The problem is there are so many contradictory stories and legends from the Old West that we often don't know which ones are true. One historian or author says something and claims it's a fact, and then people repeat it, and even though it might have just been made up, people start believing that it truly occurred. Here's an easy example. Billy the Kid was left-handed. Spoiler, he was not. Why do people think Billy the Kid was left-handed? There's only one photo that is considered to legitimately be Billy the Kid. There are one or two other photos that might be Billy the Kid. In that famous picture, Billy the Kid is standing holding a rifle in his right hand and wearing his pistol on his left hip. Based upon that, people thought he was a lefty. There was even a movie in 1958 starring Paul Newman as Billy the Kid called The Left-Handed Gun. The problem is the photo was reversed. At some point, an observant person noticed that the buttons on his vest are on the wrong side. Even back in the 1880s, men's clothes had buttons on the right side of a shirt, vest, or jacket. This is how people determined that the photo was reversed, meaning that his gun was actually on his right hip and Billy the Kid was most likely right-handed. The point of this story is that once a supposed fact is printed in a book, article, or even worse now, the internet, it gets repeated over and over and believed when it's often untrue. Some of the supposed facts about Wyatt Earp might be true or might have just been mistakes or pure fabrications. With those disclaimers in mind, let's see how much we really do know about this larger-than-life figure of the 1800s American West. Wyatt Earp was born on March 19, 1848 in Monmouth, Illinois. It was a large family. He had four sisters as well as five brothers. When Wyatt was around 1 year old, the family moved to Iowa. That's where Wyatt grew up, on a farm near Pella, Iowa. Although he wanted to fight in the American Civil War, he was too young. But his older brothers did fight for the Union Army. While the Civil War was still raging, Wyatt's father, Nicholas, moved the family to San Bernardino, California in 1864. This was travel by the classic wagon train. It seems that Nicholas Earp always thought that the grass was greener someplace else and moved once again in 1868 to Missouri. By this time, Wyatt was 20 years old. It appears that he moved to Missouri about a year after his family did, meaning 1869. This was where Wyatt got his first job as a lawman when he was appointed constable of Lamar, Missouri. Fun fact, Wyatt Earp is not even the most famous person to live in Lamar, Missouri. It's the birthplace of President Harry S. Truman. According to the Missouri State Parks website, you can still visit the house where Truman was born on May 8, 1884, in Lamar, Missouri. In 1870, Wyatt married Eurilla Sutherland. They had a house in Lamar, and Eurilla was expecting their first child when she died of typhoid fever. This devastating loss made Wyatt go off the rails for a while. He left Missouri, and his life spiraled downward. Around a year after his wife's death, Wyatt was arrested in Arkansas for horse theft in the Indian Territory. Horse theft was a capital offense in those days. It wasn't like stealing a car today. If you get convicted of stealing a motor vehicle, you go to jail, but you do not face the death penalty. The reasons they hanged horse thieves in the 1800s were, number one, it was very easy to steal a horse, when most of the time they were just tethered to a hitching post where anybody could untie the horse, hop on, and ride off. So they made the penalty extremely high to prevent this easy theft. Number two, and a more important reason, was that a horse was often a life or death necessity. You could ride through a lot of barren parts of the American West on a horse and carry your necessities for life, but on foot, you might not make it. Purportedly, Wyatt avoided the hangman's noose by escaping from the jail at night with a few other prisoners. Either Wyatt or one of the other prisoners figured out that the roof of the jail was not very secure because it was made out of wood. Somehow, Wyatt and the other prisoners lifted each other up to the ceiling and broke through the wooden roof and escaped at night. After escaping his jail cell, Wyatt went to Peoria, Illinois. During this time in his life, Wyatt was working in the prostitution business. Some sources say that he was working as a pimp. Other sources state that he was a security guard for a brothel, kind of like a bouncer, someone to keep the customers in line. We don't know for sure, but it appears that he was actually living in a brothel. There was a period of time that he was romantically involved with a prostitute named Sally Heckle. Sally began calling herself Sally Earp, but we do not believe that they were actually married. Prostitution was illegal in Peoria, Illinois, but in most places in the Old West, prostitution was legal. Almost every thriving town in the Old West had one or more brothels, especially in the cow towns and mining towns. Prostitution was legal in Arizona until 1918, and that was 6 years after Arizona became a state. In the 1880s, when Wyatt Earp was living there, Tombstone, Arizona issued town licenses for prostitution. It was okay to work as a prostitute, you just needed a license. At some point in his life, Wyatt claimed that he worked as a buffalo hunter somewhere around 1874. We don't know if this was true or not. Buffalo hunting was a large business for a short while. It entailed shooting large numbers of buffaloes who were often just standing still and then cutting off their hides. They would leave the rest of the carcass to rot on the prairie. The only reason why the business did not last for very long was because the hunters killed literally millions of these large animals and that there were not many buffaloes left. Before the 1800s, when Americans started slaughtering the buffaloes, it's estimated that the Great American Plains held somewhere between 30 and 60 million buffaloes. They were almost killed to extinction. The buffaloes have made a nice comeback in certain national parks. If you ever get the chance, I would highly recommend a visit to Yellowstone National Park for about 1,000 reasons. But one of the highlights is seeing buffaloes just roaming around. They are enormous and very impressive. And they seem even larger when you are sitting in a Dodge Neon with your wife and little kids and you realize that the buffalo could easily destroy your crappy car. Throughout his life, Wyatt Earp had a lot of diverse jobs. He was often a lawman. It seemed for a while he shot buffaloes. There were times he held some mining interests. He operated saloons. He was a gambler. He was a faro dealer in saloons. And he rode shotgun on stagecoaches. When you're getting into a car and somebody says, "I call shotgun," meaning the front passenger seat, that's where that term riding shotgun comes from. While one man handled the horses, which pulled the stagecoach, another was sitting next to him, armed with a shotgun, and had to be ready for would-be thieves. Around 1874, Wyatt Earp moved to Kansas. Wyatt first built his reputation as a tough lawman while working in the cow towns in Kansas. Towns like Wichita and Dodge City were wild and fairly lawless places. These towns sprang up as places for Texas ranchers to bring their cattle to the nearest railroads. This is why they were called cow towns. In that time period after the Civil War, the nearest practical railroad stations for the Texas cattlemen were in Kansas. These were the days of those large cattle drives on trails from Texas to Kansas. The most notable was the Chisholm Trail. These herds were sometimes in the thousands. It's estimated that approximately 5 million head of cattle from Texas were brought to Kansas over the Chisholm Trail. Texas ranchers took their cattle to the stockyards in Kansas, where beef could then be shipped to the large cities of the Midwest and the Northeast. Because of the higher prices for beef in the large cities of the East Coast and Great Lakes regions, it was economically worth it for the ranchers to have these large cattle drives to towns like Abilene, Wichita, and Dodge City. These cattle drives could take up to 2 months, and there were a lot of natural hardships along the way, including crossing rivers, which of course did not have any bridges. But there are also man-made perils. The men driving the herd had to beware of rustlers who were always armed. Getting back to Wyatt Earp, there was a desperate need for some law and order in these Kansas cow towns. You had young men reaching Dodge City or Wichita or Abilene after approximately 2 months on a cattle drive. They now had money in their pockets and they wanted to cut loose. This meant a lot of drinking, gambling, and chasing women. And the women included prostitutes and non-prostitutes alike. So what was life like in these towns with all of these young guys who had seen themselves living outside of any legal authority for a couple of months? They were aggressive and cocky and felt invincible. Added to this fact that they were drunk most of the time, and worst of all, everybody was carrying at least one gun. Fights broke out over gambling, women, or a million stupid reasons. Wyatt's first cowtown was Wichita, Kansas. I have seen him listed as either a deputy marshal or a policeman. The terms are often used interchangeably. Whatever was his actual title, to use the Old West term, he was a lawman in Wichita. After about a year in Wichita, Wyatt moved to Dodge City, Kansas. That was the most famous cowtown of them all. Dodge City had the nickname of the wickedest little city in America. We have statistics from Dodge City for the period from 1876 to 1885. During that 10-year period, 1.65% of the population was murdered. That means an adult living in Dodge City during that time period faced a 1 in 61 chance of being murdered within 10 years. Would you live in a city with those odds? Wyatt became deputy marshal in Dodge City around 1876. At some point, Wyatt went to Deadwood in the Dakota Territory. But he returned to Dodge City within a year and resumed his work as a deputy marshal. During his work as a deputy marshal in the Kansas cowtowns, it appears that Wyatt only shot and killed one man. He was mostly famous for physically beating criminals, usually hitting them with his pistol. He was an intimidating figure. He stood 6 feet at a time when very few Americans were that tall. During the 1800s, a lot of western areas of the U.S. were divided up into territories before they became official states. During that time that Wyatt was working in Wichita and Dodge City, Kansas was already a state. In case you're thinking that Kansas is not part of the West, you're right. It's now considered part of the Midwest. But it was considered the West in those days because it was on the frontier. The way things usually worked was that Congress would divide up public lands known as unorganized territories into organized territories. Sometimes all of that territory became a state, and sometimes only part of a territory became a state. Usually territories were admitted as states once they had a population of over 60,000. And while we're talking about territories becoming states, I have to address Arizona, where the gunfight at the OK Corral took place. Arizona was the last of the contiguous 48 states to be admitted into the Union. Arizona became a state on February 14, 1912. The most interesting and most tragic of the federal territories which became states was what was known as Indian Territory. If you look at a map of the United States, you would see that the cattle drives from Texas up to the cow towns of Kansas went through what is now the state of Oklahoma. The cattle drives had to trespass across land that had been supposedly permanently set aside for the Native Americans. This area was called Indian Territory, and it now makes up most of the state of Oklahoma. It's a long and tragic story, which I can't get into detail here, but here are the essential points for today's episode. As Americans of European descent took more and more land from the Native Americans, they simply pushed the Native Americans further and further west. The area which now constitutes all of Oklahoma, except for that narrow panhandle in the western part of the state, was designated as Indian Territory. Under the Indian Removal Act of 1830, several Native nations were forcibly removed from their homes in the southeastern part of the United States and relocated to Indian Territory. This forced relocation of Native Americans was the infamous Trail of Tears. The reason they selected the area, which is now Oklahoma, was because it was a remote part of the United States. In 1830, Texas and the current states west of Texas were still part of Mexico. The thought was that the Indian Territory would be a buffer between the U.S. and Mexico. Texas became an independent country in 1836, so the Indian Territory was still a buffer between two independent countries. Most people in the American government thought that this was a very generous deal to the Native Americans. They were being given approximately 44 million acres of fertile prairies. Of course, the Native Americans did not see it that way. Naturally, they looked at it that they had originally had all of the land that had become the United States, and now they were being forced into one small section of that land. Indian Territory was supposed to belong to the tribal nations forever. The Native Americans were told that non-Native Americans would be barred from trespassing into the Indian Territory. In a long list of unfortunate events for the Native Americans, Texas joined the United States in 1845. This meant that instead of being a buffer area between two countries, Indian Territory was now completely surrounded by the United States. And as I described earlier, the period after the Civil War was the heyday of the cattle drives from Texas up to the Kansas cow towns, where they had to cross more than 200 miles across Indian Territory. You already know how this ends. Eventually, white people wanted that land in Indian Territory. Parts of Indian Territory were open to settlement by non-Native Americans. These were the famous land runs in Oklahoma. These events are sometimes referred to as a land run or a land rush. The first occurred on April 22, 1889. President Benjamin Harrison signed a federal law which designated a part of Indian Territory as public domain and available for settlement. It didn't matter that this land was in the middle of what was supposed to be permanent Indian Territory. And of course, the Native Americans were not consulted in any of this. These land runs were wild events where cannons would be fired at noon and people could rush in and claim 160 acres of public land. The amount of land and the way it was claimed was pursuant to the Homestead Act of 1862, which had previously been used to populate most of the plains in the middle of the U.S. Some people went into the public land early and hid so they could claim the best lands when the land run started with the boom of the cannons. Those people who cheated and went in early were called Sooners. That's where we get the name of the University of Oklahoma sports teams, Sooners. Eventually, Oklahoma became a state. It was admitted as the 46th state on November 16, 1907. The idea of a permanent, expansive Indian Territory was abandoned. The Native Americans were left with reservations throughout various states. Let's get back to Wyatt Earp and Dodge City. When he returned to Dodge City from Deadwood, Wyatt also rejoined the police force as a deputy marshal. In the Old West, there were three levels of lawmen. There was a town marshal who was either elected or appointed. There was a county sheriff who was usually an elected official. And there was a federal officer called a U.S. marshal who was appointed. All three levels had deputies. While working as a deputy marshal in Dodge City, at some point around 1877, Wyatt was given a temporary commission as a deputy U.S. marshal to track down an outlaw. Wyatt went all the way to Texas looking for the outlaw. It was on that trip that he met a gambler known as Doc Holliday. All right, it's now time for a little diversion into the life of Doc Holliday. If you've heard of Wyatt Earp, you've most likely also heard of Doc Holliday. His real name was John Henry Holliday. He was born on August 14, 1851 in Georgia. The reason everybody called him Doc was because he was actually a dentist. He graduated from the Pennsylvania College of Dental Surgery in Philadelphia and had set up a dental practice back in Georgia. He was an educated man and supposedly could speak Latin. Unfortunately, he was diagnosed with tuberculosis. Thinking that the hot, dry climate would help with his disease, He moved to the Southwest. He first moved to Dallas, Texas, and set up a dental practice there. But because of the many bouts of coughing from his tuberculosis, he was unsuccessful as a dentist. Doc Holliday soon became what was known as a sporting man. This meant that he made his living as a gambler. Doc moved around a lot. We know that he lived for a while in Denver, Colorado, Deadwood in the Dakota Territory, Wyoming, and Dodge City. At some point, he developed a relationship with a woman known as Big Nose Kate. I hate to call her that, but unfortunately, that's how she's become known over the years. Her real name may have been Mary Catherine Horony, or possibly Kate Elder. We just don't know. From what we know, they were never married, but she stayed with him for years, including traveling with him to Tombstone, Arizona. This is probably a good time to talk about Wyatt's romantic interests. As I explained earlier, as a young man, Wyatt was married to Urilla Sutherland, who unfortunately died of typhoid in Missouri. Wyatt was then involved with a prostitute named Sally Heckle, who used his last name, but it appears that they were never actually married. While living in Dodge City, Wyatt became romantically involved with a prostitute named Maddie Blaylock. It appears that they were never legally married, but he considered her his common-law wife. That is why you often see her referred to as Wyatt's second wife. Maddie traveled with Wyatt when he moved to Tombstone, Arizona in 1879. While living in Tombstone, it does not appear that Maddie was working as a prostitute. However, she did develop an addiction to laudanum. That was a popular drug in the Old West. Laudanum was made up of a 10% solution of opium powder in alcohol. Wyatt and Maddie were living together in Tombstone. This did not stop him from becoming romantically involved with a woman named Josephine Marcus, who I'll tell you more about later on. After the shootout at the OK Corral, Wyatt wanted to get his family out of Tombstone because of the escalating violence. In 1882, Wyatt sent Maddie with his brother Virgil and Virgil's wife, as well as Morgan's widow, to California. Wyatt never saw Maddie again. Maddie's life continued spiraling downward. She returned to prostitution, and on July 3, 1888, she died from an overdose of laudanum. Her death was ruled as a suicide. Both Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday occasionally made money as faro dealers. That was a popular card game at the time. I've seen it in so many movies, but never knew how it was played, so I had to look up the rules. Here are the basics. The players played against the dealer, kind of like blackjack in modern casinos. The dealer was considered the house. Two decks of cards were used. The dealer would place all 13 cards of one suit face up on the table. Didn't matter what suit was used. The 13 cards from 2 through ace were laid out, and this was called the tableau. Then the dealer would take the second deck of cards, regular deck of 52 cards, which would be shuffled. The dealer would then burn one card. This meant he would turn over one card and place it on the side. This card would be face up so the players could see what card was discarded. Now the players would place chips, like poker chips, on one or more of the 13 cards facing up in the tableau. This meant they were betting on that card. Suits did not matter. So if the player places his bet on a jack, that means he's betting on any jack of any suit. The dealer then turns over two cards. The first card flipped is the loser. The second card flipped over is the winner. If the player put his chip on the jack and the jack came up in the first card, the player lost and the bet would be collected by the dealer. If the player had put his chip on the jack and a jack came up in the second card, the player won and the player would be paid. Bets were paid on a 1-to-1 ratio. This means if a player won, he or she received exactly what they had bet. The flip cards were placed to the side and another round began. This means that the players could see which cards had already been dealt. Players could move their bets around to different cards or keep them where they were. If the dealer turned over two cards and the losing card and the winning card were of the same rank, for example, two queens, the dealer would take half of any bets on that card. In this example, the queen. There are some other minor rules, but I just gave you the primary ones. Both Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp ended up back in Dodge City. While in Dodge City, Wyatt became good friends with another famous Western lawman, Bat Masterson. First of all, I love that a guy with the first name of Bartholomew went by Bat. It just sounds badass. Bat Masterson also became one of those larger-than-life characters from the Old West. Wyatt and Bat gained reputations as tough deputies in Dodge City. There's a story that Doc Holliday saved Wyatt's life one time in Dodge City. Supposedly, when Wyatt entered a saloon, two or more cowboys got the drop on him and pointed their guns at him. But Doc was playing cards and, to use their parlance, got the drop on the cowboys. We think this is a true story because later in life, Wyatt used to tell people that Doc had saved his life one time in Dodge City. This might explain why they became such close friends. Besides being a professional gambler, Doc Holliday also got a reputation as a skilled gunfighter. There were wild speculations about how many men he had killed in his life. We don't know who came up with this number, but somebody claimed that Doc Holliday had killed 16 men, and you will see that figure a lot. It appears to be a gross exaggeration. Historians believe that they can document 3 men that were killed by Doc Holliday. Were there more? We'll probably never know. In 1877, a new mining boom town of Tombstone, Arizona, was founded by a prospector named Ed Schieflin. He gave the town that unusual name because when he told people he was going to search for silver in the area, supposedly somebody told him that the only thing he would find would be his tombstone. The discovery of silver made Tombstone one of the last mining boom towns in the Old West. In 1879, Wyatt Earp and his common-law wife Maddie moved to Tombstone. The following year, Doc Holliday and his significant other Kate also ended up in the growing town of Tombstone. Some of Wyatt's brothers were also in Tombstone. There was an older brother named James Earp who lived in Tombstone when Wyatt was there, but you never hear anything about him because he wasn't involved in the gunfight at the OK Corral. The same holds true with his younger brother Warren Earp. You don't hear much about him because he also wasn't involved in the famous gunfight. But Warren does play a big role in the Earp Vendetta ride, which I'll describe later on. The two brothers I will focus on now are Virgil and Morgan because they were involved in the famous gunfight. The shootout at the OK Corral occurred on October 26, 1881. As I explained at the beginning of this episode, the gunfight did not really take place in the OK Corral. It took place in a vacant lot on Fremont Street in Tombstone. On one side, there were the three Earp brothers, Wyatt, Virgil, and Morgan, along with Wyatt's close friend, Doc Holliday. On the other side, there were some of the cowboys. Nowadays, we use that term cowboys as a generic term for people who work on ranches. But in Cochise County, Arizona, the cowboys referred to a specific group of outlaws. President Chester A. Arthur even referenced them in his first annual message to Congress on December 6, 1881, when he said, "The acting attorney general also calls attention to the disturbance of the public tranquility during the past year in the territory of Arizona. A band of armed desperados known as cowboys, probably numbering from 50 to 100 men, have been engaged for months in committing acts of lawlessness and brutality which the local authorities have been unable to repress. The depredations of these cowboys have also extended into Mexico, which the marauders reach from the Arizona frontier." President Arthur made those remarks about 6 weeks after the gunfight at the OK Corral. The cowboys were not an organized gang the way we think of organized crime today. They were kind of a loose confederation of criminals, mostly involved in rustling cattle and other robberies. There was no organizational structure, meaning that there was nobody who was the leader of the cowboys. They simply affiliated with each other and formed different groups for different crimes. We don't know how many people they killed, but we do know that most of the cowboys did not like the Earp brothers. For all of the bad blood between some of the cowboys and the Earp brothers, there's still plenty of accounts of them continuing to interact with each other, including playing poker together. As I explained earlier, there were 3 levels of law enforcement in Arizona Territory: U.S. Marshals, County Sheriff, and Town Marshals. In October 1881, the sheriff for Cochise County was a man named Johnny Behan. He did not get along with the Earp brothers. There were several reasons why Johnny Behan did not get along with the Earps, particularly Wyatt. One reason was that Behan defeated Wyatt in an election for county sheriff. Another reason was that Johnny Behan was sympathetic to the Cowboys and did not even seem to try to suppress their criminal activities. But probably the biggest reason was that Wyatt and Johnny Behan were interested in the same woman, Josephine Marcus. Sometimes she's referred to as Sadie, but it appears that her real first name was Josephine and that she went by Josephine or Josie. We think that Josephine Marcus arrived in Tombstone in 1880 when she was somewhere around 19 years old. For a while, she lived with County Sheriff Johnny Behan. But at some point in 1881, she left Behan for Wyatt Earp. Keep in mind that Wyatt was still living with Mattie Blaylock, who considered herself his common-law wife at the time he started the relationship with Josephine Marcus. At that same time, October 1881, while Johnny Behan was the sheriff for Cochise County, Virgil Earp was both a U.S. deputy marshal as well as the town marshal for Tombstone. To try to curb the violence, the city council enacted a law in the spring of 1881 which prohibited anybody from carrying a firearm within the town limits. There were several witnesses to the actual shootout at the OK Corral. Unfortunately, the descriptions from the participants and the witnesses are very different. After the gunfight, there was a criminal case brought against the three Earp brothers and Doc Holliday. Much of the information we have regarding the famous gunfight comes from the testimony at the preliminary hearing in front of Judge Spicer. Leading up to the shootout on October 26, 1881, one of the cowboys named Ike Clanton was supposedly telling everybody who would listen that he was going to shoot the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday. Word of this got to the Earp brothers. Friends had told Virgil, the town marshal, that Ike Clanton and some of the other cowboys were in that vacant lot on Fremont Street next to Fly's Photography Gallery and that they were carrying guns. This was against the local ordinance prohibiting carrying guns within the town limits. Virgil decided that he was going to go down to that vacant lot and disarm the cowboys. Virgil took along his two brothers, Morgan and Wyatt, and he also took along Doc Holliday. As the four men walked towards the lot where they expected to see the cowboys, County Sheriff Johnny Behan came up to them and said that he had already disarmed the cowboys and there was no reason to go there. Behan later disputed saying this, but if he did say it, the Earps and Doc Holliday didn't believe him since he was friends with the cowboys. All four men carried six-shooter pistols. Doc Holliday also had a double-barreled shotgun. When the Earps and Doc Holliday arrived at the vacant lot on Fremont Street, there were six cowboys present. Ike Clanton, his brother Billy Clanton, Frank McLaurie, his brother Tom McLaurie, Billy Claiborne, not to be confused with Billy Clanton, and Wes Fuller. There's a dispute as to whether Wes Fuller was in that vacant lot, but it seems that he probably was. Billy Claiborne and Wes Fuller were apparently unarmed and ran away either just before or right after the shooting began. That left Ike and Billy Clanton and Frank and Tom McLaurie facing the Earps and Doc Holliday. Wyatt testified at the preliminary hearing in front of Judge Spicer describing the gunfight. The man that Wyatt testified that he did not know was apparently Wes Fuller. Here's the pertinent part of Wyatt's testimony. Quote, "We came up on them close. Frank McLaurie, Tom McLaurie, and Billy Clanton standing in a row against the east side of the building on the opposite side of the vacant space west of Fly's Photograph Gallery. Ike Clanton and Billy Claiborne and a man I don't know were standing in the vacant space about halfway between the Photograph Gallery and the next building west. I saw that Billy Clanton and Frank and Tom McLaurie had their hands by their sides. Frank McLaurie and Billy Clanton's six-shooters were in plain sight. Virgil said, 'Throw up your hands, I have come to disarm you.' Billy Clanton and Frank McLaurie laid their hands on their six-shooters. Virgil said, 'Hold, I don't mean that, I've come to disarm you.' Then Billy Clanton and Frank McLaurie commenced to draw their pistols. At the same time, Tom McLaurie throwed his hand to his right hip, throwing his coat open like this, and jumped behind his horse. I had my pistol in my overcoat pocket where I had put it when Behan told us he had disarmed the other parties. When I saw Billy Clanton and Frank McLaurie draw their pistols, I drew my pistol. Billy Clanton leveled his pistol at me, but I did not aim at him. I knew that Frank McLaurie had the reputation of being a good shot and a dangerous man, and I aimed at Frank McLaurie. The first two shots were fired by Billy Clanton and myself. He's shooting at me, and I shooting at Frank McLaurie. I don't know which was fired first. We fired almost together. The fight then became general. After about four shots were fired, Ike Clanton ran up and grabbed my left arm. I could see no weapon in his hand and thought at the time that he had none, and so I said to him, "The fight has commenced. Go to fighting or get away," at the same time pushing him off with my left hand like this. He started and ran down the side of the building and disappeared between the lodging house and the photograph gallery. My first shot struck Frank McLaurie in the belly. He staggered off on the sidewalk, but fired one shot at me. When we told them to throw up their hands, Claiborne threw up his left hand and broke and ran. I never saw him afterwards until late in the afternoon after the fight. I never drew my pistol or made a motion to shoot until after Billy Clanton and Frank McLaurie drew their pistols. If Tom McLaurie was unarmed, I did not know it. I believe he was armed and fired two shots at our party before Holiday, who had the shotgun, fired and killed him. If he was unarmed, there was nothing in the circumstances or in what had been communicated to me or in his acts or threats that would have led me even to suspect his being unarmed. I never fired at Ike Clanton even after the shooting commenced because I thought he was unarmed. I believe then and believe now from the acts I have stated and the threats I have related and the other threats communicated to me by other persons as having been made by Tom McLaurie, Frank McLaurie, and Ike Clanton, that these men last named had formed a conspiracy to murder my brothers, Morgan and Virgil, Doc Holliday, and myself. I believe I would have been legally and morally justified in shooting any of them on sight, but I did not do so, nor attempt to do so. I sought no advantage when I went as deputy marshal to help disarm them and arrest them. I went as part of my duty and under the direction of my brother, the marshal. I did not intend to fight unless it became necessary in self-defense and in the performance of official duty. When Billy Clanton and Frank McLaurie drew their pistols, I knew it was a fight for life, and I drew in defense of my own life and the lives of my brothers and Doc Holliday. End of quote. Some of the witnesses, including Ike Clanton, disputed Wyatt's testimony. We will never know exactly what happened, but the following facts seem generally agreed upon. Number one, Billy Claiborne and Wes Fuller were probably unarmed and ran away either just before or right after the shooting began. It appears that they ran out through the back of the vacant lot. Number two, Ike Clanton did approach Wyatt, yelling that he was unarmed. He grabbed Wyatt, and Wyatt threw off Ike Clanton, and then Ike ran away. Number three, nobody shot at Ike Clanton. Number four, Morgan Earp was shot in the shoulder. He would later recover. Number five, Virgil Earp was shot in the calf and would also recover from that injury. Number six, Doc Holliday was grazed by a bullet but not seriously wounded. It's unclear, but I think they grazed him on the side of his torso. Number seven, Tom McLaurie was killed by a shotgun blast from Doc Holliday. Number eight, Frank McLaurie and Billy Clanton both died of multiple gunshots, including the first shot by Wyatt, which hit Frank McLaurie in the abdomen. Number nine, when the shooting was over, only Wyatt Earp was unscathed. Number 10, and here's the craziest fact about this gunfight. When the shooting started, they were all within approximately 10 feet of each other. That is insanely close. Number 11, we don't know what time the gunfight took place, but it was sometime in the afternoon of October 26. Number 12, most people agree that the entire gunfight took only about 30 seconds. Look around you. 10 feet is not that far away. Imagine seven armed men all shooting in such a close proximity. Think about this scene immediately after the gunfight. Billy Claiborne and Wes Fuller had run away and were not part of the gunfight. The McLaurie brothers and Billy Clanton were dead. Virgil and Morgan Earp were both shot. Doc Holliday was grazed by a bullet. Ike Clanton had run away. And Wyatt Earp, who had been in the middle of the fight, stood there without a scratch. This certainly helped with the larger-than-life legend of Wyatt Earp. From what we know, throughout all of the gunfights and standoffs with violent armed men, Wyatt was never shot. It was mostly luck that he was never shot and lived to be an old man. But the fact that he was never shot after leading such a violent life helped with the whole avenging angel persona and the myth of Wyatt Earp. The next day, Tom McLaurie, Frank McLaurie, and Billy Clanton were all buried in Boot Hill Cemetery. Yes, that's a real cemetery in Tombstone. However, it didn't get its colorful name until the 1920s to make it more of a tourist destination. When it opened in 1879, it was just called the City Cemetery. And when they built a new cemetery in 1884, then this one was just called the Old Cemetery. Wyatt, Morgan, and Virgil Earp, along with Doc Holliday, were arrested for murder. On November 30, 1881, after 4 weeks of testimony and a preliminary hearing, Judge Spicer dismissed the charges against all four men. Judge Spicer ruled that Virgil Earp was in his right to disarm the cowboys as the town marshal and that the other men were acting as Virgil's deputies. One of the key factors that has to be considered in determining whether the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday were in the right or in the wrong is the fact that nobody shot at Ike Clanton. Remember, Ike Clanton was the guy who was the chief instigator of this fight. The fact that none of the four men took a shot at Ike Clanton because he was unarmed helps to justify the claim that they were simply defending themselves when they went to disarm the cowboys. The dismissal of the case against the Earps and Doc Holliday was not the end of this feud. 1 month after the dismissal of the murder case against the Earps and Doc Holliday, some men tried to kill Virgil Earp. Late in the evening on December 28, 1881, Virgil was shot by approximately three men. We don't know for sure, but suspicions at the time and today were that the three men were Ike Clanton, Curly Bill Brocious, and Will McLaurie, brother of two of the men who died at the OK Corral. Virgil was hit with buckshot from shotguns. He surprised many of the people at the time by surviving. However, he lost the use of his left arm for the rest of his life. 3 months later, on March 18, 1882, Morgan Earp was shot while playing a game of pool when he was shot through a window. The bullet struck him in the back, and he died shortly thereafter. Nobody was ever convicted for the murder of Morgan or the attempted murder of Virgil. However, Wyatt Earp took matters into his own hands. After Virgil was injured, Wyatt replaced Virgil as the deputy U.S. Marshal. 2 days after Morgan's murder, Wyatt was getting most of his family out of town. Virgil and another Earp brother named James were taking the body of Morgan Earp to California for burial. They were leaving by train with their wives. Maddie Blaylock, the woman who was living with Wyatt, was also going with them. Wyatt and Doc Holliday and Wyatt's younger brother Warren accompanied the Earp family to the train station in Tucson. There may have been a couple of Wyatt's friends with him as deputies. Wyatt had been tipped off that some of the cowboys were going to try to kill Virgil before he left Arizona. At the train station in Tucson, Wyatt found Frank Stillwell and Ike Clanton. Yes, again, Ike Clanton. Wyatt killed Frank Stillwell, but Ike Clanton got away. After seeing that his family had gotten safely away on the train to California, Wyatt went back to Tombstone. He formed a posse which included Doc Holliday and his younger brother Warren, and we think these three other men, Texas Jack Vermillion, Turkey Creek Johnson, and Sherman McMaster. There may have been others, it's unclear. By the way, I just love those nicknames of Texas Jack Vermillion and Turkey Creek Johnson. While Wyatt and his posse went looking for the cowboys who had attacked his brothers, County Sheriff Johnny Behan got arrest warrants for Wyatt, Doc, and some others for the murder of Frank Stillwell at the Tucson train station. Think about what a crazy situation this was. U.S. Deputy Marshal Wyatt Earp is leading a posse looking for some of the cowboys for murder and attempted murder, and at the same time, County Sheriff Johnny Behan is leading a posse trying to capture Wyatt and his friends for murder. This was chaos. Within a few days, Wyatt and his posse caught up with a man named Florentino Cruz, who for some reason everybody called Indian Charlie. It was believed that Florentino Cruz had been involved in the murder of Morgan Earp. Wyatt later admitted to killing Cruz, but claimed that it was a fair gunfight. Who knows what really happened? But Wyatt had now killed two men who were supposedly involved in the murder and attempted murder of his two brothers. Within a few more days, the Earp posse got into a gunfight with more of the cowboys along a stream known as Iron Springs. There are disputed versions of this gunfight. Some claim that the cowboys ambushed the unsuspecting Earp posse. We don't know exactly what happened, but one thing we do know. Wyatt Earp killed Curly Bill Brocious with a shotgun blast. It appears that Wyatt also shot two other cowboys named Johnny Barnes and Milt Hicks. Johnny Barnes later died of his wounds, but Milt Hicks recovered. County Sheriff Johnny Behan's posse never caught Wyatt or the members of Wyatt's posse. There are contradictory statements about exactly what occurred after the gunfight at Iron Springs, but at some point, Wyatt and the rest of his posse left Arizona Territory. It seems that they went to Albuquerque in the New Mexico Territory, and that's where they split up. The exact tally of the Earp Vendetta ride will probably never be known, but it seems that Wyatt Earp, maybe with the assistance of his friends, killed Frank Stillwell, Florentino Cruz, Curly Bill Brocious, and possibly Johnny Barnes. One other name might be added to that list. Johnny Ringo had achieved some fame as a gunslinger and a member of the Cochise County Cowboys. Ringo was found dead in July 1882 in a canyon outside of Tombstone from a gunshot to the head. The death was ruled as a suicide, but there were lots of rumors that either Wyatt Earp or Doc Holliday had killed Johnny Ringo. Around March 1882, Josephine Marcus left Tombstone. She moved to San Francisco. This was right around the time that Morgan Earp was killed. After Wyatt Earp's Vendetta ride, Wyatt went to San Francisco and got back together with Josephine Marcus. At some point, they got married. At least Josephine claimed that they got married. From what I can tell, there's no actual documentation of the marriage. They stayed together for the next 46 years until Wyatt died in early 1929. Wyatt Earp did not have any children. Josephine and Wyatt traveled and lived in many places throughout the western U.S. and even Alaska during the Alaska Gold Rush. Josephine, who had witnessed Old West events in Tombstone, Arizona, lived to see most of World War II. She died in December 1944. She and Wyatt were both cremated and their ashes are buried together in Colma, California. In 1976, a book was published titled I Married Wyatt Earp. At first, the book was heralded as being the memoirs of Josephine Marcus Earp, who had died 32 years before the book's release. The author claimed that he had used two manuscripts written by Josephine. After several years, there were serious questions about the authenticity and accuracy of the book. But before the book was discredited, it was made into a TV movie in 1983 starring Marie Osmond as Josephine Marcus. As I mentioned earlier, Doc Holliday was suffering from tuberculosis. Some have speculated that the terminal illness was why he led such a wild and dangerous life of gambling, drinking, and gunfights. As his health deteriorated, Doc Holliday moved to Glenwood Springs, Colorado. The waters were supposed to be curative, but they did not help his condition. He died on November 8, 1887 from tuberculosis. He was only 36 years old. There was a saying in the Old West about dying with your boots on. This was a reference to dying while fighting. Doc Holliday probably expected to die with his boots on. In the last moments of his life, Doc Holliday was supposedly struck by the irony of dying a peaceful death in his room at the Hotel Glenwood. Purportedly, he looked down at his bare feet, and his last words were, "This is funny." I don't know if the story is true, but I really hope it is. Doc Holliday is buried somewhere in the Linwood Cemetery outside of Glenwood Springs, Colorado. I say somewhere because nobody knows the exact location of his grave. You have to hike a short trail to where there is a little monument for Doc Holliday. He's buried somewhere in that cemetery, but nobody knows exactly where. As I told you earlier, Wyatt Earp and his wife Josephine traveled and lived in many locations. Wyatt Earp spent his last years living in Los Angeles. He was fascinated with the movie industry and liked to visit the movie shooting locations. Some people claim that he was an unpaid film consultant for some of the Western movies. There's a fabulous story that Wyatt met a young actor named Marion Morrison, who would later change his name to John Wayne and star in a lot of Westerns. According to the story, John Wayne patterned himself after Wyatt Earp. Unfortunately, from what we know, this story is not true and that they never met. It's just another example of the legend of Wyatt Earp that goes well beyond true facts. One of the reasons why Wyatt Earp is so famous today is because he's one of the few of those Old West figures who lived to old age. He died of natural causes. We're not quite sure, but the most common cause of death I find for him is chronic cystitis. I have no medical background at all, but according to the Mayo Clinic website, it is a disease of the bladder. Wyatt died on January 13, 1929, at the age of 80. He died in his home on 17th Street in Los Angeles. I live here in LA, and I would love to go see the house where Wyatt died, but there's nothing to see. The house is no longer there. The location of Wyatt Earp's bungalow is now the site of Johnny L. Cochran Jr. Middle School. That's it for today. Please tell your friends, relatives, and coworkers about History Analyzed. Word of mouth is the best way to increase the audience for this podcast. Please subscribe to this podcast, and please like this and my other episodes. Ratings and likes greatly help. If you are listening on an app that allows for reviews, I would greatly appreciate a kind review. Please check out my website, historyanalyzed.com, where you'll find lots of goodies for history geeks. Thank you for listening. Catch you next episode.